I'm going to waffle on here for half an hour or so, so you've got plenty of time to actually read it when it comes to you. These are actually copies of the two diplomatic, in the UK we call the basic means of communication which diplomats use within the Foreign Office. We call them diplomatic telegrams. In Washington they call them diplomatic cables. I'm not quite sure what the Germans call them, to be honest. But these are copies of the two diplomatic cables I sent back to London about receiving intelligence and torture in Uzbekistan. I've known from speaking to one or two of the interns here particularly, but there are people here who are considering a career in diplomacy. You may like to look at these carefully because you'll be able to know that if you write something like this, you will get sacked, which is, you know, useful career advice. But do have a look. They do contain a number of acronyms which you won't be able to understand. These are copies which I obtained under the Freedom of Information Act in the United Kingdom. Being obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, before giving them to me, the British government literally cuts out bits, it redacts them, it censors part. And about half the content of this one and a quarter of the content of that one is redacted. And they do it, they quite literally cut with scissors and a razor and then photocopy again. And they do the cutting just to make sure there's no photocopying mistake but with Tippex or whatever. This is a wonderful sign of how government can be Kafkaesque, because these are both documents I wrote. And to give me a copy, they have cut out bits of what I wrote in the hope I don't remember what was there, which I think is really quite amusing. But even with those redactions, and equally, they were classified top secret. And one of the things they have cut out is where it said top secret, because the classification top secret is a government secret. You're not allowed to know that the classification top secret exists, even though everyone does know that exists. An introduction to, as I say, the Kafkaesque Western world. Now, I'm going to give these to you to read as I talk, because they're probably more interesting than my talk. And if you can, I'll put one each side. As I say, you do have time to actually read it and before you pass it on. And then when they get to the end, if you could swap them over and send them down the other side. These are my two cables on intelligence under torture. Which leads me to wander gently around to the subject of the talk. Realism or hypocrisy, Western diplomacy and freedom of expression. And I'm not going to keep you on tenterhooks as to what my conclusion will be, and I'm not going to advance a lengthy argument leading to a conclusion. I'll tell you that, in my view, Western policy on freedom of expression and on other human rights, because I think freedom of expression is very interesting, because it's a very good barometer for human rights in the country. I don't know of any government which doesn't allow freedom of expression, which does not also commit a great many other human rights abuses. So freedom of expression is a very good measure of human rights in a country. And I think we're hypocritical in two ways. The first way is that we are, and the most obvious way, is that we are extremely hypocritical about those countries in which we seek to target freedom of expression, in which we regard the lack of freedom of expression as a problem, and those countries in which we downplay it and don't say anything about it, for reasons of what's known as realpolitik. But I also think we're hypocritical in another way, which is that we ourselves in Western countries practice much less freedom of expression than we think we do. We receive a much less broad, particularly through the media, we receive a much less broad range of information and range of views than we realize. And that's perhaps where I'll start. Now, much of what I say comes from my personal experience, because largely that's my best chance of telling you things you don't already know. And also comes from examples taken from my own country, the UK, and from countries in which I served. But I think a lot of it has universal application. And I think we can extrapolate from what I say to the situation in other countries. And let me start with a personal anecdote. We have a television program in the UK called Question Time, in which a representative of each of the major political parties and then one or two other less political guests answer questions on the political matters of the moment from a studio audience. It's a prestigious program. It's a BBC flagship program. I used to watch it when I very first got interested in politics back in my teens, and it still goes on to this day. And I was extremely delighted. I'm genuinely honored, I would say, to be invited to take part two or three years ago. Taking part in Leeds, and I was actually on a train, not on the train to Leeds, but on a train to an interconnecting station to catch a train to Leeds, when my telephone rang, and I was told that, it had been decided that as international relations weren't much in the news that week, I didn't ought to take part in the program. After all, somebody else was being substituted. And I said, I was on the way there, and I was bitterly disappointed. I had been appearing, since leaving the Foreign Office, life for whistleblowers is not easy. I'm not asking for your sympathy, though if anybody wants to take a collection and give me some money, it's very welcome, but life is not, it is not easy to become a whistleblower, because all organizations, every organization, be it a business, be it a newspaper, the one thing they value most in their employees is loyalty to that organization. And there's a view that if you've been, in their view, disloyal to your past organization, for whatever reason that may be, you are not a trustworthy employee. I know, whistleblowers are a small group. There are 5 or 6 people I can mention in the UK. Not many more in the States who are major whistleblowers. We all know each other. We keep in touch with each other. We meet each other. We have a kind of mutual support organization. Virtually no one has ever managed to get a job. Some obtain more respectability than others. Our kind of godfather, the person who mentors us and is very kind to us, is Dan Ellsberg in the States, who has at least made some sort of career. But in terms of ever being again in any situation of responsibility or in any regular paid employment, it's almost impossible. I still do jobbing bits of journalism. I give talks at places where some of which pay good money and some don't. One of the things I used to do was actually appear quite regularly on the BBC giving commentary on various programs, which used to pay small money, but it was helpful. And I two or three years after I left the Foreign Office, I was appearing in total 30 or 40 times on BBC radio or television programs in a year, a bit less than once a week, culminating in that invitation to appear on Question Time, which was cancelled at the last moment. Since then, I've been invited. I have been keeping a count of this on my blog. I can't actually remember where the count is now. I think it's 32 times now I've been invited onto BBC programs. And every time, out of 32 consecutive times, I've been phoned up and cancelled before the program happened. There have been two exceptions. One was an appearance on Newsnight to talk about the Uzbek cotton industry, where I went on, it wasn't live, it was a feature in the program. I went in on that afternoon, was filmed, gave my interview, but although the feature ran on the Uzbek cotton industry, my bit was cut out, didn't appear. And the only time out of these 32 times I did get on was a radio program which had a guest presenter, a gentleman called Peter Oborn, who's a very interesting yes, very interesting journalist, I was going to say, of eclectic views, he did have, he was a guest presenter on a program. He wanted to have me on. And he said to the BBC, I'm having Craig Murray, and if I'm not having Craig Murray, we're cancelling the show. And as he'd been announced as the guest presenter and things, he managed to get me on. Now, I do not know the mechanism. I do not know the mechanism. I genuinely don't, by which I'm banned from the BBC. I don't know how it happens that researchers or producers thinking up the guests they want to comment on a particular program, think, oh, Craig Murray's good. Somebody phones me up. Somebody books me. Then at some stage in the next, usually in the next 2 or 3 hours, a mechanism kicks in and I get phoned back and I'm cancelled. I don't know the mechanism used to make that happen. Somebody, not me, put in a Freedom of Information request to the BBC, which is a public body, asking for any documents on Craig Murray, on the decision to cancel him on Question Time that time, and on why he's been disinvited from so many BBC programmes since. And the BBC replied that that there was an exemption under the Freedom of Information Act for matters relating to journalism, and the decision not to invite me was a journalistic decision, therefore exempt from the Freedom of Information Act request, which is fascinating, because that means, according to the BBC, censorship and journalism are identical things, which is not something most of us would talk about. So I'm merely giving my own example. And as I talk to you more, when I finish, you can ask me questions, I think you realize I actually do not have any views which are not held by quite a large proportion of the population and which are not, you know, reasonably respectable over dinner party. I do not have extraordinary views of a kind that need to be banned from the airwaves. I do have a different critique on foreign policy than the one you generally hear, a different view of government than the one you generally hear in the media, and I have, of course, a professional background that enables me to speak in that way with some authority. One thing, in my view, that happened with the Occupy movement, and I went down, I lectured at the Occupy London site, I spent time there, I met the people there. In my view, the media were actually deliberately cherry-picking people from the Occupy movement as spokesmen, precisely because they appeared to be rather inarticulate, disorganized. Or that's one of the problems with something like the Occupy movement, which has a philosophy of not having leaders and not having official spokesmen. Because when you're an organization and you do have an official spokesman, you choose someone who's good at it. If you say, we don't have anyone, you know, it's all free and open, you give the media a point of view. And I have no doubt in some interviews I saw that the but people from the Occupy movement were being put up by the media's representatives in the knowledge that that person was not up to the job. And that's why that person was selected by the media. I just put that out as another way I feel the media operates. You know, again, on this subject of media identification, in the UK, opinion polls showed continually that between 30 and 35%, there really wasn't a great deal of variation, of people were against the intervention in Libya, were against the bombings in Libya. Of journalistic output in the mainstream media concerned with the subject, I confess I didn't do a survey, I saw virtually nothing. Seamus Milne. Almost alone. On the BBC, both the line taken and the way it was reported left it as though there were no question. And now I'm a professional diplomat. I was a professional diplomat. I've drafted Security Council resolutions. I've negotiated on Security Council resolutions. There's no doubt at all that the initial no-fly zone was legal in international law. It is arguable, either way, legitimately, that the attack from the air on Gaddafi forces which were threatening Benghazi was legal. That's arguable. It is beyond doubt illegal for NATO forces to have gone on once the Gaddafi forces were essentially defeated, to carpet bomb Sirte, killing more people than have died in Homs, something which you won't see reported in the media, mainstream media at all. Nothing in UNSCR 1970 or 1970 urged NATO to take a side in the Uzbek civil war and bomb the other side into submission and made it, in effect, a capital offense to be a Gaddafi supporter. And I should say, I've met Colonel Gaddafi. I've negotiated with him, discussed with him when the African Union was founded. I have no time for Gaddafi at all. Of course, I'm sorry he died in that horrible way. I wouldn't want that to happen to anybody. But I'm in no sense a supporter of him. I'm not unhappy that he's gone. But what NATO did in the latter stages of the conflict was plainly illegal. There was a very good explanation of vote on Syria by the Russian delegation to the Security Council, in which he said, and I, again, reported nowhere in English media. In fact, I used to, when I was ambassador in Tashkent, I had, of course, to speak Russian. I used to be reasonably fluent in Russian. Now it's quite difficult for me, but I can translate a written piece of text into Russian. I couldn't find the UN English translation online. I found a Russian translation on their mission website, and I translated it myself. And actually, it was very eloquent. He said, we have seen in Libya what the West means by the doctrine of the responsibility to protect. We have seen a no-fly zone meant to stop aerial warfare used to justify the mass bombing of the town of Sirte and other towns. We have seen a resolution which we were assured when it was passed did not encompass regime change, used to justify regime change. When we have been cheated on the Libya resolutions, why would we pass any resolution on Syria? And again, I am by no means a fan of Putin. I actually am a major critic of the Putin regime. But there's a great deal of truth in what that Russian ambassador said about what's happening in Libya and what's happening in Sirte and the Western the Western attitude to it, and what, in my view, were Western attempts to hijack and control the forces unleashed by the Arab Spring. And yet that's not, as I say, there's been no fair reportage anywhere in the UK media of that Russian position, and no attempt at it. We get, the same is true of the war in Afghanistan, where the amount of, there is no correspondence whatsoever between the views of the British people on the war in Afghanistan and the way it is reported in the media. And there has to be an extent to which social media, networking, Twitter, Facebook, is providing an outlet for ordinary people to express views which the mainstream media has advocated, because the mainstream media is almost entirely signed up to a neocon agenda of continual war. I was phoned, I have a blog, and I'm a whistleblower myself. I'm a reluctant whistleblower. As you'll see from those telegrams going around, I was attempting internally, using classification in secret, to stop the policy of obtaining intelligence from torture. And I did think I would be able to stop it. I had no idea that government ministers throughout the civilized so-called world had decided that we should use torture as an instrument of policy. I thought this must be something which the security services were doing without the knowledge of politicians, and that I would be able to stop it. That's why I sent those telegrams. In fact, sadly, the West had moved to a policy of advocating torture. I was seeing it in Uzbekistan, but the same was true. When Mubarak fell, suddenly the whole media changed sides. Suddenly we were reading things about Mubarak's regime and how terrible it was, which we hadn't been reading in the media much at all for years and years. And Mubarak's regime hadn't suddenly got any worse in the last few months. It had always been that bad. And indeed, Mubarak's torture chambers were also providing intelligence to the CIA and to MI6. And so were the torture chambers of pretty well all of the dictators who are now being attacked in the Arab Spring. You have Saudi Arabia sitting like the spider in the center of the web, a country with a dreadful human rights record, which is virtually never, ever criticized by the West. Saudi Arabia is slightly more criticized in the Western media. It's not criticized at all by Western governments, because Western governments actually don't really care about this human rights stuff. They pretend they care about the human rights stuff because there's a constituency at home which cares about the human rights stuff. If you have somebody like me who tries to take them at their word in promoting human rights in a country in which they have other interests, that person becomes a threat to the state and has to be removed as a threat in any way. Bahrain, we have this extraordinary situation where Western support for the Arab Spring evaporates when it comes to Bahrain and the Saudi invasion of Bahrain. I had a friend in a diplomatic mission at the United Nations in New York. You may recall that the Americans were pretending in public to be against the bombing of Libya right up until the last moment. A lot of propaganda was put out saying the American military against it, they're not prepared. All the time that propaganda was put out, they were moving the military assets into place to do it. I had a friend in New York who phoned me before either the UNSCR 1970-1973, while those resolutions were under discuss at the United Nations, and before the invasion of Iraq. So this is not post hoc rationalization, and you can find the entry I put on my blog saying this before any of these things happened. A friend of mine at the United Nations phoned me, and he said, the Americans are cutting a deal whereby they will okay the Saudis to invade Bahrain in exchange for an Arab League call for NATO to go into Libya. That's how cynical realpolitik is. That's how diplomacy really works. And remember that when you see Western leaders criticizing human rights in other countries, that actually they are engaged in the most cynical of maneuvers, which almost always come back to obtaining control of physical resources. Let me take you back to Uzbekistan. Why there were we getting this intelligence from torture? The intelligence we got from torture was rubbish. I think one of those telegrams I sent starts by saying, this is useless, immoral, and illegal to obtain this intelligence from torture. And it really was. The intelligence vastly exaggerated the size of al-Qaeda in Central Asia. What was happening was President Karimov, who runs what on all measures by in all human rights organizations have Uzbekistan down as one of the worst dictatorships in the world. He was obtaining a great deal of Western support, including, according to a recent survey by the Open Society Institute, back then in 2002, 2003, he was getting over $2 billion a year from the United States, mostly from Pentagon budgets, into his armed forces and his security services, and a fair bit into his own pocket, in exchange for which he had given the Americans and the Germans both air bases in Uzbekistan to support their military operations in Afghanistan. And Uzbekistan, of course, neighbors Afghanistan. And that's the ostensible reason for our support of the Uzbek regime, because of logistic supply into Afghanistan. But if you dig a little bit deeper, you discover that in 1997, the Uzbek ambassador, Sadiq Safayev, held a meeting in the Texas governor's office with George Bush, while George Bush was governor of Texas 3 years before he became president. George Bush held a meeting in the governor's office in Austin with the Uzbek ambassador and with Enron. And Enron signed a deal to tie up Uzbekistan's oil and gas, in effect, to market it to exports in Europe. And the access route out was to be by a gas pipeline to be built over Afghanistan, running, incidentally, through the Trans-Afghan pipeline still exists. The Asian Development Bank is, it exists as a plan. The Asian Development Bank has signed up to fund it. At that time, when George Bush Jr. was meeting the Uzbek government and Enron in the Texas governor's office to sign this up, the contract for the Trans-Afghan pipeline was with another company called Unocal. Unocal were actually in talks with the Taliban to protect the pipeline. On the board of Unocal at that time was George Bush Sr. And the consultant paid by Unocal, who was conducting the negotiations with the Taliban, was a certain Mr. Karzai, which I hope gives you some indication. When people say that foreign policy is driven by a search for hydrocarbon resources, in large part, or other resources, that isn't theory. It's not rationalization. It's true in a very dull, real-world way. You know, if you read my book, Murder in Samarkand, you'll actually see there are facsimiles of the documents surrounding that meeting with the Bush and the Uzbek government and Enron. There's a copy of a letter from Enron to George Bush confirming the meeting and what it's about. These things really do happen in the real world. Western policy is driven by very hard financial interests, the interests of a very elite bunch of people who control a great deal and indirectly control the media narrative that surrounds the explanation the public is given as to why these wars, these attacks on human rights happen. To go back to that intelligence in Uzbekistan, there has to be a reason why you're supporting the Uzbek dictatorship with a lot of money and training for their armed forces. This is one of the worst dictatorships in the world. How do you justify giving that dictatorship support? Well, you justify it as part of a war on terror, and that you're backing them against Al-Qaeda. Except that there is no Al-Qaeda in Uzbekistan. There's virtually no Al-Qaeda presence in Central Asia, but certainly none in Uzbekistan. Virtually none. I should say I'm not one of those people. There are people who don't believe Al-Qaeda exists. They are perfectly entitled to their view. From the work I was doing, the access I had, I have no doubt whatsoever from direct evidence of the existence of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda exists. It's not nearly as big as it was made out to be, or as dangerous as it was made out to be, but it does exist. This intelligence material, poor people were being taken off the streets, political prisoners. It could be for almost any reason. I knew one chap who actually worked for the University of Westminster. He was an Uzbek. He had a dispute with a member of the security services who wished to take his orchard in order to build a pub and restaurant on that orchard. And the way Uzbekistan works, totalitarian dictatorship, in order to get his orchard, the member of the security services just had the guy picked up and taken into custody, where he was tortured into confessing to Al-Qaeda membership. And he did. Torture in Uzbekistan is extremely prevalent. And by torture, the famous cases of people being boiled alive, and they really happened. I got the evidence. I got detailed photographic evidence. I sent it back for an autopsy report to the University of Glasgow pathology department. We particularly had very detailed photographs of one corpse, which was in extraordinary state. The guy who did the autopsy report from his detailed photographs is now the chief pathologist of the United Kingdom. He said that the chap had had his fingernails pulled out. He'd been beaten about the face and the neck, and he died of immersion in boiling liquid. He'd been boiled alive. And it was immersion, not splashing, so there was a clear tide line running right across the chest and the upper limbs and 100% scalding underneath. That's extreme, but the smashing, but the forcing of a limb into boiling water was not unusual. The smashing of knees and elbows, the sexual molestation, genital mutilation, rape, and very frequently the torturing of children in front of parents until they confess. In these circumstances, the Uzbeks were getting literally hundreds of confessions to Al-Qaeda membership every year. And these confessions were coming to me as CIA intelligence reports. And often they contained information which I knew not to be true. And because we were also sometimes able, you know, occasionally someone would escape, someone would be released because of, someone was able to exert influence, get them released. We were learning also from our investigations into torture, we were learning what people had to confess to under torture. And they had to confess to membership of Al-Qaeda. They had to confess to traveling to Afghanistan, to meeting Osama bin Laden in person, taking part in Al-Qaeda training camps. And they had to sign up to long lists of other people and say, yes, these are also members of Al-Qaeda. Very often, they'd no idea who those people were, but they were given the list. And the truth of the matter is, almost everybody in this room, probably everybody in this room, including me, if they were cutting off your genitals, you would sign. Almost, and if they were doing it to your child, you would sign even quicker. Almost everybody signs. But very often, we were able, occasionally, we were able physically to check some of this CIA intelligence. There's one example I like to give. I'm not sure if in Germany you have the Jehovah's Witnesses, or what you call them here. There was one list of Al-Qaeda people. Sometimes I would see names of people I knew, named as Al-Qaeda people in these long lists. Once I saw the name of a professor in Tashkent who I knew. I'd been to dinner with the man, and he was and is a Jehovah's Witness. And he was named by the CIA as a member of Al-Qaeda. Now, there are not many Jehovah's Witnesses in Al-Qaeda. I actually doubt that Al-Qaeda even try and recruit Jehovah's Witnesses. I no doubt the Jehovah's Witnesses would try and recruit Al-Qaeda if they could find them, but I don't think it works the other way around. You know, so much of this material was nonsense. There was material about training camps that named locations with coordinates given where we knew we had been there and there was nothing. But the extraordinary thing is, what got me in more trouble than anything with the Foreign Office, they hated the fact I was protesting about intelligence from torture. What they really hated was the fact I was saying the intelligence wasn't true and giving examples of it not being true, because they were saying it's high quality intelligence. This is building into our intelligence picture. And remember, I was called back to a meeting where basically I wasn't sacked immediately at that meeting, but the process was started. And that meeting took place 2 weeks before we invaded Iraq. I was saying your intelligence is rubbish. And at precisely that same time, of course, we had published the dossier on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, which contained a lot of other intelligence material, which was also rubbish, was completely untrue. And I knew that as well, having been head of the Foreign Office unit in charge of embargo surveillance. So I'm afraid to say that in both the United States and the United Kingdom, the analysis of intelligence, which is something I had spent quite a lot of my career doing and at which I believe I was very good, had ceased to be a genuine intellectual exercise in determining the facts and had become instead a process of providing lies to government that government wanted to publish, making the world as it was. The government wanted to support Karimov for reasons of oil and gas and the war in Afghanistan. There needed to be a reason for supporting him. Therefore, there needed to be Al-Qaeda activity in Central Asia where it did not, in fact, exist. And the media is complicit in this building of lies. And this is where I want to widen it out to the war on terror more widely. Eliza Manningham Buller, who was then head of MI5, about 3 years ago, made a major speech in which she said there are 2,200 active Islamic terrorists in the United Kingdom, 2,200. And she made plain in her speech that she didn't mean supporters of terrorism or those who provide logistic support. She meant people actually personally prepared to carry out a terrorist act. There were 2,200 active Islamic terrorists in the United Kingdom. This is not true, is it? It just isn't true. It's what the intelligence says, because it's what the government wants the intelligence to say. And a lot of those people in Uzbekistan who were tortured were tortured into talking in particular about Al-Qaeda plots in Germany. And there have been trials of people in Germany as a result of that kind of intelligence. And the strongest supporter of the Uzbek government in the West is actually the German government, not the United States government, which is a terrific shame on Germany and on the people of Germany. But those 2,200 Islamic terrorists of Eliza Manning and Buller, much of that comes from intelligence obtained under torture build, and it cannot be true. There are 2,200 active Islamic terrorists in the UK, have been, you know, for, she made a speech 3 years ago. In that 3 years, they have killed precisely nobody. They must be the worst terrorists in the world. And the truth of the matter is, I mean, unfortunately, there was a terrorist attack by entirely homegrown terrorists who were entirely homegrown terrorists whose motive was they were outraged by our complicity in torture abroad, as one of them said on their suicide video. There has been one terrorist attack in which about 60 people were killed. There have been a couple of failed attempts. But in fact, the number of people who have died of terrorism in the UK throughout the war on terror is far, far less than were killed in the Troubles in Northern Ireland, even when were killed in mainland UK during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. But that's not the impression the media gives you. In fact, there has only been 1 year, there's only been 1 year since 2001 when more people have not died of drowning in their bath than have been killed by terrorists in the UK. On average, about 18 people every year in the United Kingdom die because, usually because they're drunk, they drown while taking a bath. In the last 11 years, that's 198 people have died of drowning in the bath. While in that same period, I think 62 people have been killed by terrorists. You have three times as much chance, statistically, of drowning in your bath as you have of being killed by a terrorist. And yet, we've got the press reporting absolutely uncritically, not one mainstream media, not even The Guardian, said bollocks when she said there are 2,200 active Arab terrorists in the UK. And Tony Blair said that the war on terror, Islamic terrorism, was a fundamental threat to our civilization on a par with World War II. It's nonsense. Everybody in this room has a much, much greater chance of being struck by lightning than being killed by terror. That's not fictitious money. That money exists. An insignificant percentage of that money went to pay the soldiers. Most of it went to arms companies and suppliers of private mercenary security companies and companies like the Halliburtons. People, there are people who have become millionaires in a big way. I mean, there are individuals who have made hundreds of millions out of war profiteering. And then you have to look at that nexus of corporate structures and who finances the politicians and who finances much of the mainstream media. And that gives you some idea of the nexus of lies, false narratives designed to promote interests which ordinary people are up against. And I'm sorry to say that the terms of political debate have narrowed. I want to give you one example from the UK. And it comes from someone who's a hero of mine. I've told you before, I'm a liberal. I don't view myself as a left-wing person. Everything I've said today would have been a perfectly normal thing for anyone to have said in 1977. Today, it somehow puts me on the far left, which is really, really scary. Because the terms of debate have narrowed. A great prime minister of the United Kingdom, back in the 1870s, William Ewart Gladstone, was campaigning against, he was in opposition, he'd been prime minister, he was now leader of the opposition, and he was campaigning against the Second Afghan War as part of his election campaign. And he made a speech in Midlothian in Gladstone, which became a very famous speech, which when I was a young man was in the standard history textbooks, Gladstone's Midlothian campaign. It isn't anymore, it should be. Gladstone made a speech in which he referred to British soldiers driving out Afghan women and children from their villages into the snows of Afghanistan. And he said, the humble half of an Afghan civilian should be as sacred as yours and mine. And he said, the Afghans are fighting our troops. If they resist, would you not do the same? And that's a man who was four times prime minister, who won that election, becoming prime minister for the third time at that stage. If they resist, would you not do the same? No mainstream politician in any of our countries could get away with, would be allowed to say that the people fighting our troops are right. Because nowadays, false patriotism and supporting the troops is such a stream, and I blame the media, and I blame those who work in the media who give into it. The notion that anybody fighting our soldiers may have right on their side is not a notion that anyone will find any example of any mainstream Western politician, let alone someone who'd been prime minister twice and going on to be prime minister twice, making. The terms of debate have narrowed. What you are allowed to think and still be respectable has narrowed. These are extremely dangerous trends in our society. And that's what lies behind the Patriot Act and this raft of ludicrous authoritarian measures that we face. I happen to believe that the Karimov regime is so extreme and such a barbarous dictatorship that I do not condemn any Uzbek who takes up arms against it. Provided, of course, he's not indulging in behavior which randomly endangers civilians. But in my view, armed struggle against a real dictatorship, a totalitarian dictatorship, can be an honest choice. Now, what I've just said is illegal. I've just glorified terrorism under the UK definition of terrorism and the act that prohibits the glorifying of terrorism. Because the terms of debate are now that narrow. And the failure, the abject failure, of the mainstream media, largely because of the ownership structures of a vast majority of them, to take this on, is why social media is a vital force in society now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Murray, for the excellent lecture, which I think we all really, really appreciated, especially given the topic of the conference.
Hi, my name is Ingrid Kragl. I'm a Belgian journalist based in Paris for the moment. Talking about freedom of expression, and as you are a diplomat, I would be interested in hearing your comment on the French law on the so-called Armenian genocide. You may know that 2 days ago, the Constitutional Committee has censored that law, so it cannot be applicable. And talking about international relation and the consequences of the whole stuff, because this law has existed for years and years and years, and the whole story, the whole pressure about it, I would be interested in having your views on it.
Hello, I'm Vuk Vukotic. I'm a student at Vilnius University. You mentioned in the beginning of your speech about how the Western, particularly Britain, doesn't have the other side of the media story, and you mentioned Russia in that context. Do you perhaps, I'm just wondering now, because you live in Lithuania where Russian media is quite popular, especially RTV, which is quite new. And I don't know if you watch it, but do you think global media with the kind of a Russian worldview, like RTV, could bring some kind of different perspective or different angle of view at these, well, quite important things to the Western media?
Hi, Mr. Craig Murray. I think this is a historic moment. It's the first time that I see somebody talking about human rights this way, because I agree with you. And when you said that the social media is the only way to at least create awareness about this false human rights appeal of the Western diplomacy, do you think that exactly because the social media is so important at this moment, that actor is the ultimate attack on freedom of expression, and it's the ultimate act of terrorism of our governments to stop social media, to tell us what you are telling us now. Thank you.
The question on the Armenian genocide law in France and the limits on freedom of speech is an interesting one. I don't believe that freedom of speech is an absolute. I do believe there are occasions when it should be stopped. It's very hard to formulate precise rules for that, and it depends on context and also timing, strangely. John Stuart Mill, who is my philosophical guide in life, wrote in On Liberty that to argue that corn merchants are evil robbers who batten on the starvation of the poor is a perfectly valid, legitimate argument to put it in a pamphlet. But to say the same thing to a rioting mob holding torches outside a corn merchant's house in the middle of the night is different. And I think that's true. But it's very hard to quantify why context is important. But I think to deny the Armenian genocide happened, or deny it was a genocide, or say it was all just part of a war or whatever, I find it hard to imagine a context when you shouldn't be allowed to say that if that is what you actually believe. I have a problem in Germany with the laws on Holocaust denial. I served in the British Embassy in Warsaw. I was involved in organizing the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, for example. So I met many concentration camp survivors. I even met some people who were involved in the administration of the concentration camps, incidentally. So I have no doubt at all that the Holocaust happened. But should it be illegal to say it didn't, if that's actually what you believe? I'm not sure it should be illegal. In my view, limitations on freedom of speech, I think governments are the worst people in the world to determine what is truth and what is not. And when you have a law limiting specifically what you can say on a certain subject, that is a government deciding the truth. And governments are the most unscrupulous and self-interested organism which man has yet invented. So the idea that governments can be the arbiters of intellectual truth, I think, is a very, very dangerous one. So on balance, I'm with the court and against the government in France on the Armenian genocide issue. On the media, actually, I think Russia Today, or whatever it's called, is very, very good as an alternative news source. I mean, it really is good, as long as it's not talking about Russia. On almost every other subject, it actually gives a very interesting and different perspective, which is worth hearing. I mean, personally, what I do an awful lot is I will hop between the channels. I will see, what Sky Fox are saying for a laugh. I'll see what the BBC is saying, which, interestingly, 5 years ago, you could think would be different to what Sky and Fox were saying, and is no longer different to what Sky and Fox say, which is slightly scary. But then I'll see CNN, then I'll see Russia Today, then I'll see CCTV, the Chinese channel, and I'll watch Press TV, just to get the different perspectives. And I think the ability to do that, unfortunately, it's not an ability a lot of people take. But Russia Today, a lot of their stuff is extremely good and thought-provoking and interesting, especially that amusing chap who does the economics. And as long as they're not talking about Russia, where everything they say is a load of lies, it's worth looking at. They actually sent me a very expensive-looking, high-definition webcam so they could interview me a few weeks ago, but they haven't actually got around to interviewing me. But I do have a webcam, which is very nice. On social media, I think we are going to see, undoubtedly, governments are going to try to take, to narrow in and reduce this freedom, which has burst out all over the place. Governments have a growing intolerance for freedom of any kind. I predict over the next, under all kinds of pretexts, paedophilia is always a very good excuse for stopping anything, because no one can argue. I think we're going to find an increasing raft of government legislation throughout the Western world attempting to attack internet freedom. I've got no doubt that's coming, and I've got no doubt it should be resisted. But the internet does seem to have this wonderful ability to work around censorship attempts in one way or another. You know, no matter how people try to block information, eventually a workaround seems to get found. Even in Uzbekistan, people manage occasionally to see my website. One thing I want to add, it's very hard for those of us in the West to realize in a totalitarian dictatorship how absolute control of information is. In May of 2005, the Uzbek government killed 700 or 800 demonstrators, shot them dead in Andijan, where they crushed an attempted pro-democracy uprising. That was the only time I've ever known Uzbekistan to be the lead news item on the BBC. And it was probably actually that day, the day they killed 700, 800 demonstrators, Uzbekistan was probably the lead news item everywhere in the world, everywhere in the Western world, for one day. 5 days later, I was speaking on the telephone to people in Tashkent who did not know it had happened. And that is what life is like in a genuine totalitarian dictatorship.
Hello, I just wanted to ask you one thing, because obviously you've been on an extraordinary journey yourself of learning. And you have a website, and you do talks like this, and you've published a book. In terms of all the kind of controls of information, what have you found the best ways of sharing what you know?
I think undoubtedly the web. When I left the Foreign Office, the day I officially left, my immediate thought was to get out the information of what happened to me as completely as I could. And I'm not, this is not being melodramatic. I knew David Kelly, for example, professionally. My first thought was, I have to get everything I know out in order to minimize the incentive to kill me. On that day, those documents I obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, I didn't have those particular documents, but I had related documents, and I put them on my own website, and by contacting other bloggers who contacted other bloggers, on day one, we got them onto 3,000 websites worldwide. And by sort of day five, from websites we could calculate, with a certain amount of extrapolation, but we calculated there'd been 20 million hits worldwide by day five. And that was before the invention of WikiLeaks. The net is the most extraordinary enabler. And also, incidentally, it also shows WikiLeaks, I know Julian Assange and I like him, but WikiLeaks is only a publisher. It's not a whistleblower, it's only a publisher. And we did it before WikiLeaks, and if WikiLeaks goes under, we can still do it. It's only an enabler. It's not that important. But undoubtedly, the web is, and I have spoken probably. I must have given 100 talks like this one since I left the Foreign Office. The largest ones have had, audiences of 2,000, maybe. The smallest one I ever did was 4, I think. But if you add all those people up, and you don't get, 5% of one day's circulation of David's newspaper, of course, you are going to go home and say, I just heard the most amazing man give a talk, and word will spread in that way. But what you can really do by old-fashioned means of political organization is very small, unfortunately. The web is more helpful. But even then, my blog, we bloggers like to exaggerate. We always say how many unique visitors we get per month. My blog gets 120,000 unique blog visitors a month when I'm writing it. Last week, I haven't been doing it because occasionally I get depressed. But on a normal day, that's 10,000 people. Normally. And my blog is in the Cision rankings of UK social media. My blog's number 7. People like Guido Fawkes, really, and he talks about 400,000 unique visitors a month or whatever. That actually really means about 25,000 a day. And that's the biggest blog in the UK. The important thing about the social media is its aggregation, that there are so many of us, and you add it all together. But the influence an individual blog can have. Probably at least 50 or 60 of my stories have been printed up, taken out, and reprinted by the mainstream media. Then they get seen. But I wouldn't exaggerate too much what you can do on a on a blog. Document leaks and things get information out very well because people want to see leaked documents.
Okay, thank you very much, Ambassador Murray.
Thank you.